When I was a freshman in high school, I had two transformational experiences that I'll never forget. The first of which took place during basketball season. Now, I was a good basketball player in middle school and played on some pretty good AAU teams. They were fairly high level. And because I went to a small Christian school, I made the varsity team as a freshman. Through the first third of the season, I fared all right, coming off the bench and contributing. And I had a couple of games where maybe I cracked double digits in scoring. But one night, my entire hoops trajectory changed. We were playing one of the best teams on our schedule, and I started off the first half playing pretty strong. I had 12 points and was feeling pretty confident heading into the second half. The game was tight, and heading into the fourth quarter, I scored a couple of buckets. It was like a switch got flipped in my brain, and everything changed in the room, and the entire experience of the game changed. Suddenly, everything I threw at the hoop went in. And they tossed every possible defender they could at me, and it didn't matter one bit. I had no idea in the moment how many points I was scoring. I just knew that I was in the zone. It turned out that I scored 26 points in that fourth quarter alone. Now, I had tastes of being in the zone like that before in basketball, and maybe even some other sports. And of course, growing up on NBA Jam, we always joked about catching on fire after three straight makes, but I had never been in that kind of zone before. It was amazing. Later in the spring of that same freshman year of high school, we were in the middle of a fairly typical Christian school chapel when all of a sudden, everything in the room seemed to change. Everyone around me began to weep in worship. I found myself weeping in worship. And the singing just didn't stop. None of us wanted to stop singing. And so the teachers ended up canceling class for the rest of the day, and we just kept worshiping, praying for each other, and being caught up in what we would have described as a sense of revival and a baptism of the Spirit. I honestly could have just kept going in that moment all day, and many of us tried. When the school day ended, many of us moved to the choir room to keep going. And then when our parents came to pick us up from school, we begged them to bring us back later that night so we could all meet up and do it again. And most of our parents did. And these experiences happened almost every weeknight for at least a month or two. In many ways, these two experiences might seem completely unrelated to some of you, but if, like me, you've ever been in the zone in a sport or playing a musical instrument and you've just been locked in, you've been in the pocket, whatever you want to call it, and maybe you've also had a religious experience that some might call an experience of revival or renewal, then you know that the experiential similarities between those all feel like they have a lot in common. I've been fascinated with those experiences for years and trying to figure out what was it about those two different experiences that when I look back on it, they actually felt so similar. And so when I came across scientific literature on what psychologists like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi called the flow state, I've been enamored with learning more about the science of the flow state, and I thought some of you might be interested in it too. So in this series, we turn our attention to the seminal work in the field of psychology entitled Flow, the Psychology of Optimal Experience by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and you'll see a pronunciation for that is very peculiar for American audiences. He's a Hungarian psychologist. You'll see his name in the description of this podcast. So in this series, we're going to unpack Csikszentmihalyi's concept of flow, its conditions, the empirical evidence for it, and how these scientific insights might intersect with religious experience and Christian spirituality. I'm Paul Anlender, and this is Deep Talks, Exploring Theology and Meaning Making. This podcast is a listener-supported podcast free of advertisement because of the generous support of listeners just like you over on Patreon. If you care to support the podcast, if it's one of your top 5 or top 10 listens, I would invite you to click the link in the description below, and you can participate in all sorts of extra fun activities that maybe will get you caught up in the flow state. Like participating in discussion forums, you can hop on Zoom calls with me and listeners from all over. And you get access to bonus Q&A episodes and a whole bunch of other things. But the biggest thing is you help keep this podcast afloat for the many thousands of listeners who tune in for free without any advertisement. So thanks for considering supporting. Maybe as I describe my experience of catching fire, of being in the zone in that basketball game, some of you maybe could think of relatable experiences in your own life. Maybe it was a different sport, maybe football, and you were a quarterback, and all of a sudden, you know, you hit four or five completions in a row, and suddenly you felt like you could throw the football with pinpoint laser accuracy to any receiver at any point on the field. Or maybe as a musician, maybe you're a drummer, and usually you're a pretty competent drummer, but you have a jam session with friends and you just find yourself like locked in and you're able to do fills and rhythms that like you normally can't do. And it just comes across as easy. And yet you have all of your focus dedicated to it. And it seems like such an enjoyable experience. If you've ever had anything like that, you've experienced what Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who again is a Hungarian, or was, unfortunately he passed away a couple of years ago, was a Hungarian psychologist who dedicated much of his life's work to the psychology of the flow state. If you've experienced anything like what I've described before, and maybe it's in the arts, or it could be in any other sort of field, it could be writing, it could be doing your job where you get locked into the moment and it feels like everything else around you is like zones out and you can lock in and you can perform at a high level and you experience a sense of joy and pleasure in your work, you are experiencing the flow state. At its core, flow is defined by several critical conditions. First, the presence of clear, achievable goals. Second, immediate feedback regarding the progress of one's actions. And third, a balance between the challenge of the task and the individual's skill level. These conditions create an environment where the individual's attention is fully absorbed, leading to the temporary suspension of self-consciousness, temporary suspension of our typical concerns for self-preservation, and the temporary suspension of even our perception of time. The experience of the flow state is marked by these characteristics. First, it feels like effortless effort. You feel like all of your concentration is completely absorbed in the activity, and yet it seems to flow. Your attention, your actions, and your decisions as you're doing said activity just seem to flow seamlessly and effortlessly, even though you're giving maximum effort to the thing that you're attending to. And it leads to this sense of total absorption in the action or activity that you're doing. The flow state is also characterized by what oftentimes athletes have described as like a voice. Athletes and individuals that are caught up in the flow have described their experience sometimes as being marked with like an intuitive voice that provides directions. Like someone downhill skiing caught up in the flow state will have this intuitive voice that tells them in the moment, go left, go right. If you're playing an instrument, you will have this intuition that maybe you're a jazz musician. You'll have this like intuition as to what scale you should play next, what arpeggio you should play next. And it's like seamless integration of this intuition and your action that some people have described as a voice. The flow state is also marked by a challenge skills balance. The golden rule of flow is maintaining a balance where the challenge of the activity slightly exceeds your skill set, necessitating a comfort with being uncomfortable. There's a paradox there, right? It pushes you slightly beyond where your skill set is at. It's not too far beyond because that triggers a state of anxiety. And it's not too easy because then you become bored. It's right on that edge, the edge of where your skill set is, and pushes you and propels you slightly beyond to make you feel as if you're performing above and beyond where you've ever performed before. which is kind of what I was describing as experiencing in that basketball game, that I was certainly, I had the skills there, but I was like maximizing them in the moment. It was pushing me beyond where I'd ever gone before. The experience of the flow state is also marked by an increase of dopamine. These activities that we perform, which give us immediate feedback, we can keep in mind feedback is an important condition necessary to enter into the flow state. We need quick and immediate feedback, and our dopaminergic system provides us that feedback. And so dopamine is released typically with an experience of novelty, risk, engaging in some sort of complex task where we are instantly rewarded by it. This is why scientists like John Vervaeke call video games flow machines, because the most immersive and engrossing games that can often lead to addictions are the ones that have completely figured out your dopaminergic system. So being in the flow state is like feeling a cascade, a waterfall of dopamine. And while thus far we have focused on flow state as an individual experience, there does seem to be a group flow state where collective activities where groups participate in together can induce a shared flow state. So you can go from being like on fire as an individual playing basketball to the entire team catching fire. You can go from playing the best pocket drum grooves and fills of your life and being in a total flow state as a drummer to your entire band being locked in the pocket together. Now, whether as an individual experiencing flow, which you can do in activities where you're by yourself, or in a group setting where the entire group is locked in together into this flow state, the scientific research is clear. Frequent experiences of being in the flow state correlate with high levels of self-reported sense of well-being and life satisfaction. People experience a greater sense of satisfaction with their life the more flow state experiences they have in their life. Now, I want to invite you to take a moment to reflect on the experiences and activities of your life that have produced the highest sense of well-being and satisfaction in life. Where do you find the most intrinsic sense of enjoyment and fulfillment? Chances are, as you reflect on those activities and you think deeply about them, you may begin to realize that you were participating in experiences that induced the flow state in you. You know, I've talked about basketball already, but when I was young, I could go up to the park and play street ball for 3-4 hours at a time. And I look back on my like maybe favorite basketball experiences. Yeah, I played in college and I played in summer league games against NBA players, and those were all wonderful experiences. But sometimes when I look back and I go, what was my best, most enjoyable experience? I think back to my street ball runs. And part of that experience was, I think there was a challenge there. There was immediate feedback in street ball, whether or not you were achieving your goals or not, either the people on the court around you are hyping you up, or you're getting immediately smack talked by someone if you underperform. I don't know what it was, but I think back on even just the loss of time, the loss of the perception of time when I was caught up in that place. I lost all sense of time. And so all of a sudden I would go back to my car. I didn't keep a watch on me. I'd check the time and be like, oh my goodness, I've been here for 3 hours and I didn't even notice it. My body felt it the next day, but I didn't even notice it. And I can get that same way now still with basketball. I can get that way with a musical instrument. I play guitar, and I can get to that point where I sit down with my guitar and I will lose track of time. I get absorbed in the experience. I get that way with writing at times, whether it's writing an article or writing for the podcast, or in the past when I wrote a book, where I just get into that moment where all of a sudden it's like I've got a challenge ahead of me, but my skill level is rising to that challenge. I am not bored. I'm not stressed. And I have found that flow channel in between. And I'm confident that many of you have experienced that on some level, in some endeavor. But I wonder how many of you have felt that experience, but also in a moment of worship as a Christian, in a moment of like community worship on a Sunday morning with others, in a moment of prayer in private or contemplation, or maybe even in an act of charity or service where you're serving someone and you are participating in these spiritual disciplines and these spiritual formation practices of our rich Christian tradition. If you have felt that sense there as well, I'm sure many of you listening have. Isn't it interesting how both of those experiences on some level can feel the same? And it's hard to articulate that to someone who's never experienced one or the other. What is that experience like? And so this is why we're going to take some time in this series to go through the work of Csikszentmihalyi, and we're going to unpack some of the concepts in his book, Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. Now, I will say, especially in the introductory chapters, there is a bit of, for me, kind of like, a pop level self-help stuff, some broad generalizations where I think Csikszentmihalyi steps outside of his areas of expertise, and it feels at times a little preachy. So that's my experience in some of the opening chapters about here's what the purpose of life is, et cetera, et cetera. When you can step back, engage with that text, and maybe set that stuff to the side and primarily engage with the science around the flow and the flow state, I think you can benefit a lot from it as a Christian, or for some of you that are listening that are just interested in religion and maybe have a general interest in Christianity. I think you're going to find our endeavors to explore the points of intersection between the science of flow and the flow state and religious experience. I hope you'll find it insightful. Csikszentmihalyi starts his book by taking us back to Aristotle and reminds the readers of Aristotle's insight that the primary goal of humans is the pursuit and experience of happiness. And he argues that even the endeavors to pursue monetary wealth, attractiveness, health, positions of authority and power are only valued because we anticipate that those things, when we attain them, will contribute to our happiness. Now, despite our substantial advancements after the industrial age and in our information age, where the rate of the standard of living, the increase in the standard of living for most people around the world has substantially risen over the past century. That's not to discount that there's extreme poverty in the world. But in many ways, especially here in America, what it means to be in poverty now is so different than when we were maybe at the start of the previous century. We've seen an increased, what we call standard of living here, increases in economic mobility from generation to generation. We've seen an increase, a huge increase in average lifespan. All of these things might lead us to believe that we have become happier people. But Csikszentmihalyi argues that we are no closer to understanding what actually contributes to a state of happiness than people were back in Aristotle's day. We don't fully comprehend what happiness is, and some may argue that we haven't made substantial progress in learning how to achieve a state of happiness. Despite material luxuries and the increase in scientific knowledge, many people in our modern West are experiencing what we have frequently referred to throughout the history of this podcast as a meaning crisis. They feel as if their lives are filled with either anxiety or complete boredom and apathy, and they find lasting happiness to be elusive. And this is still true for many people who are adherents to traditional religious stories and religious communities. The absence or the elusiveness of happiness is not something that professing Christians are immune to. So is there something that we can learn from the science on flow and the flow state that might help us get better insight into the sorts of Christian practices, endeavors, and Christian relationships to others in the world that might lead to more lasting and fulfilling sense of contentment, joy, and happiness. And here's the weird paradoxical thing about this is that Csikszentmihalyi's research demonstrated that people searching for happiness in and of itself often find that the search for happiness becomes a counterproductive engagement. They find that the experience of happiness comes not with the pursuit of happiness, but as the byproduct of a rightly ordered attentional hierarchy, where we are giving our attention to those things which are deserving of our attention. And there is something about the rightly ordered structure of attention that can lead us into states of flow that produce in us what Csikszentmihalyi calls optimal experiences. Optimal experiences are moments of deep enjoyment and exhilaration. And one of the most interesting things about the research on optimal experiences, people's self-reported optimal experiences where they experience their deepest enjoyment, exhilaration, and sense of fulfillment and happiness, is that these optimal experiences often occur during some of the most challenging activities in life. They are activities that are both challenging but deemed by the participant as a worthwhile activity. That doesn't mean that the experience in and of itself is instantly pleasurable or enjoyable. There are bodybuilders who put themselves through excruciating levels of pain but find themselves in an optimal experience because they are doing a challenging endeavor that they have deemed within their narrative structure, within the guiding story of their life, they have deemed that experience as worthwhile. And so they are challenged. The insightful research of Csikszentmihalyi, which, by the way, crosses geographic boundaries, his research involved interviews, questionnaires, scientific investigations involving thousands of individuals worldwide, across cultures, across demographics. These reveal that across cultural divide, across the specific activity that might produce an optimal experience, that there is a shared set of features with the optimal experience that leads us to believe that there is probably within the human species some kind of shared conditions and parameters which lead us to this sense of, I am doing something that I love. This is good. This is worthwhile. Now, the narrative structures that put out the kinds of like carrots and sticks that might lure us into a challenging activity are different from culture to culture. Obviously, you know, I talked about basketball as one of the places where I experienced the flow. And I look back and I go, what motivated me to become really interested in basketball? I think at a young age, I experienced the flow with it in a way that I didn't experience with the other sports that I played, at least not at the same level. But I also know that in the culture I inhabited, basketball was king. And so there was a sense in which I could achieve some social status. And that social incentive certainly pushed me to pursue that particular sport and activity with a ferocity that led me to these experiences, the flow. Now, if I were living in medieval France, that particular option would not have been on the table for me. And yet, Csikszentmihalyi's research does seem to indicate that across time and culture, regardless of the particular activity, that these sorts of conditions, I have to be challenged and stretched, and I have to see it as worthwhile. Those are the parameters which produce the kinds of environments in which one can potentially experience this flow state. And so the scientific research on this is demonstrates that, again, it is a cross-cultural phenomenon. So flow experiences aren't just limited to those who had enough time and energy and leisure in their life to play a sport and wasn't having to just be like a subsistence farmer all day. No, that doesn't seem to be a factor. It's experienced across cultures, regardless of the endeavor someone is working and investing their time into. As long as, and here again seems to be the conditions that contribute to this flow experience, person has to be in a state of mind in which their state of consciousness is ordered. It's a harmonious ordering, and in that ordering of their attention, they become fully engaged in an activity for its own sake. I know people that are artists and musicians who have no intention of becoming professional and sharing their work and selling it for money and then, you know, setting up an artist gallery. They just love the experience, painting or drawing, for its own sake. And they can become fully engaged in that activity because what that activity affords them is this harmonious ordering of their consciousness and their attention to something that they have deemed is worthwhile. But this doesn't come easily. Why is it that there are certain activities or endeavors that allow us to tap into that state, to be fully immersed in the goodness of the thing we are doing? As, again, this would be from my Christian vantage point, as simply receiving it as a gift and allowing us to respond to the giftedness and the goodness of God's created beauty in that thing, whether it's music, whether it's art, whether it's writing, whether it's a task we're performing at our job, whatever it may be, the sense that we are able to give ourselves fully to that is a way of receiving it as a gift. But what makes that state so difficult? Why are we not always in that state? If it feels so pleasurable, like if it feels so meaningful to us, why is it so difficult? Csikszentmihalyi has some reasons he believes for why it is difficult and not natural for us to simply be in that state all the time. And I want to engage with that a little bit in this next section of our podcast. And we'll do some theological reflections on points of harmony, maybe points of dissonance between Csikszentmihalyi's view on why it is difficult for us to rightly order attention. And we'll see if there's harmony. We'll see where there might be dissonance. In the opening chapters of Flow, Csikszentmihalyi argues that it's difficult for us to be in this flow state because the universe doesn't care about us. And because we enter into a world that isn't designed for our flourishing, that seems to operate by processes that are chaotic, that because of this state of the universe, events appear to us as chaotic. And so it is difficult for us to rightly order our attention when all around us is a state of chaos in which we are constantly working to figure out how to order. Now, if that state was perfectly ordered, then perhaps we could enter in and devote our attention properly. But as a result of this chaotic state of existence that we find ourselves in, it is difficult for us to extract order out of that chaos. Now, what do I think about Csikszentmihalyi's point on this? So is there points of harmony and points of dissonance? In some ways, there are points of harmony with historic Christian theology, especially when we consider the impact of what Christians throughout time have called the fall. What are the impacts of the presence of sin? Does the fall bring us into a state of relationship with the world that is not properly balanced? Are things not in a state of equilibrium? I think in some regards, there is a point of harmony with Csikszentmihalyi's point. Now, I'm not coming to it for the same reasons. I think Csikszentmihalyi is coming at this from a more reductive naturalist ontology, where the universe is chaotic, it's random, it is matter without mind behind it, like an ontological mind, a universe without a God who has ordered it, spoke it into being. And so obviously we're not coming at it from the same vantage point, but if we step back and go, okay, can we acknowledge that our experience of the world, as we enter into the world, we do not enter into a world in which we experience a total state of harmony, that there is disorder and that there is dysfunction present in our world. Now, we need to be careful to not go too far in this ditch and to jump into an almost Gnostic ditch of saying, fundamentally, the material world is broken, it is disordered, it is complete chaos, right? That would bring us into a ditch that's too far removed outside of the historic Christian perspective, because the Christian perspective starts with the affirmation of the inherent goodness. And so my vantage point on this might be to say, what is it within us that longs for an equilibrium, longs for a rightly ordered experience? Why does our attention seek to be rightly ordered? What is it reaching for? And the affirmation of an inherently good creation, a creation that was begun and brought to be by a God who brings it in as an act of love and as a gift, allows us to have a sense that what we are reaching for beyond the fall and beyond the brokenness we experience in the world, our longings for a rightly ordered, harmonious state of existence is a rightly ordered desire, a desire that understands the image, the imprint of the image of God within it, that longs for union with its source and longs to see the right ordering of all things. And so I think what's absent from Csikszentmihalyi's theology, the implied theology, is the motivation, and other than maybe just like a sort of, I don't want to go as far as to say hedonistic, but maybe a light hedonism here, that the pursuit of pleasure and happiness is in and of itself the worthwhile endeavor. That seems to be the only conclusion one could have for why they would accept the maybe ontological premises of Csikszentmihalyi's worldview and still go, I want to continue to pursue the prescription that Csikszentmihalyi sets forth for attaining more fulfillment and happiness in the work, in the things that I do, and even the mundane details of life, which he does end up kind of prescribing through his science of the flow state. And so the motivation for that, if it's not being called out of us, if it's not actually to bring us and creation into the rightly ordered state God intended for it, is probably more just a pursuit of maybe hedonistic pleasure and fulfillment. And I don't mean that in like a pleasure island or a Playboy mansion sense of hedonism. I mean that in the more ancient Greek sense, the Epicurean philosophy, right? The Epicurean philosophy, yeah, the gods exist, but they just don't care about us. So we're left to our own. And so if we have that as our reference point, what's the goal? The goal then would just be to like optimize life. Let's just optimize our state of being in a way that leads to happiness. Instead of what I would say is the Christian perspective is, I want my conscious state, the inward state of my consciousness, my inward thoughts, and the world around me to be ordered in such a way that brings about the right harmony of God's intended order for creation. Because in that, I find my highest fulfillment. In that is the right picture for reality in which reality was designed to be and will one day be in the future. That's the eschatological. I just said it in the most annoying way. Why did I say eschatological? Oh man, I've been listening to some theologians who pronounce it that way, and it's had an impact on me. The eschatological view of the final right ordering of all things. And so that is what would maybe draw out of us a motivation, not merely just for, yeah, I would love to be in the flow state again, but why is it possible that maybe this state has been designed in us so that it could potentially lead to our flourishing and the right ordering of the world around us. Now, I'm going to put an asterisk by that, and we will come back to later in the series and throughout the series. The asterisk I'm going to put by that is to say, I am not suggesting from the get-go that to be in the flow state automatically means that we are bringing our attention into right order. As we will explore in the science of the flow, all we need is an alignment of our attention to what we perceive as a worthwhile goal in between boredom and anxiety. So boredom would be where our skills are not tested enough, and anxiety would be where the skills required to attain the desired outcome are too much, so it leads to anxiety. I'm not suggesting that simply being in the flow is a good thing. There are scenarios where the flow state can be employed for ends that I would say Christians would historically agree are not for their good. We'll talk more about that later. But is it possible that is part of the way God has designed us to enter into that harmonious, right ordered relationship with Him and the cosmos that He has created, that He has put within the human species a channel by which we can move outside of our selfish concerns and preoccupations and be fully absorbed in the goodness of the thing that God has made, and perhaps the byproduct of our immersion in that moment might lead to the flourishing of other people. I'm optimistic about that. Csikszentmihalyi is also clear in his introductory chapters that part of the engagement with a world that appears chaotic and disordered to us should bring us into the realization that we have limitations. We have limitations that we cannot completely order the world around us, that we cannot completely achieve everything that we desire. And on this point, I'm in agreement with him. I'm in agreement with him that humans are finite. Our finitude is one of a property of God's right ordering and good ordering for us. We were not made to be infinite in the same sense that God is. It's ontologically and metaphysically impossible, but that's a property of being a contingent being. When we are contingent, we are also finite. And so we experience finitude as part of God's good ordering. But we also brush up against limitations because of the effects of sin in the world. And so the effects of sin in the world can create systematic limitations where we might desire certain outcomes that in this present age are simply not attainable, or perhaps in your lifetime. There are certainly those that God has called to pursue a vision of, let's say, metaphorically and analogically here, a promised land that they themselves do not enter in their lifetime, like Moses. But limitation is an important ingredient because limitation provides constraints on our attention. So we have to have limitations in order to enter into the flow state, and we have to have clear goals. Limitations provide constraints for goals. We don't have an unlimited, combinatorially explosive set of possibilities that we can give our attention to. And so finding within the set of limitations something that is worth our attention, worth going after, which we can call a goal. Goals are necessary for us to actually perceive whether or not we are accomplishing or fulfilling the thing we set out to desire. And in some ways, even if we don't articulate the goal is implicit in the activity. Yet there's also a weird paradox here where if we become too fixated on attaining the goals, we lose the enjoyment of the present moment, and then we can't get into that flow state of complete immersion in the activity. It's a weird and perplexing paradox. Without goals at all, we can't get in. And if we hyper-focus on the goal, then we can't enter into that state either. Csikszentmihalyi argues that the worldviews of old, whether they are the myths and religions of the past, whether they are nationalism or patriotism, that these stories have been have functioned as what he calls cultural shields to keep us protected from that sense of existential dread. But in our modern age, we have stepped beyond the borders of that those protective shields. And from his perspective, these, especially religious perspective, his perspective on religion, that this has been, in some sense, the religious stories and myths of old have been fabricated, superstitious stories that have given us the illusion of safety in a world that's actually filled with terror and dread. And so now that we've awoken to the reality and the death of God, that these things are false, we are stuck with that existential dread. Now, obviously, you all know, have listened to this podcast for years, I'm in disagreement with him on this point. But in some sense, I don't completely disagree, in that we have to recognize that there is a reason why the Nietzschean death of God moment happened. There's a reason why people ran away from Christendom. If we don't come to grips, even as people who claim to follow Jesus, if we don't come to grips with why people ran away and disavowed cultural Christianity and Christendom, if we don't understand why that failed and why we've turned towards this secular moment, this secular age, then we're not going to understand the potential remedies for the existential dread that seems to be unleashed upon the world if it's simply a matter of, well, we just have to go back to the good old days. No, not if we don't understand why those alleged good old days were failing. There were things there that we need to preserve, and yet there was opportunities for progress, opportunities for renewal that we missed. So I'm in disagreement. I'm in a, what would I say? I'm in partial disagreement here with Csikszentmihalyi on his view that, you know, the religions of the world have failed us, and now we just have existential dread, so we better find something else. I know in past discussions with John Vervaeke and Brendan Graham Dempsey that that's kind of been their point. We need to not just completely get rid of the stuff, but maybe we can extract the mythological truths and then and bring it into, you know, Vervaeke's religion that is not a religion. I am not there. I understand how people get to that point. I understand why Csikszentmihalyi was in a similar place, but that's not where I'm at. So as Csikszentmihalyi illustrates what he believes the problem is, it becomes clear that he also believes that some solution to this is connected to our understanding of the flow and the science of the flow state. Do I agree or disagree with him on this point? I have partial agreement, and that's why I'm so fascinated and why I want to go through this series, is that because I do think understanding the science around the flow state can help us better understand true, genuine religious experience. It can help us understand and maybe curate more thoughtfully our liturgical practices, our spiritual disciplines. It can help us perhaps engage with the goodness of God's world in a way that allows us to fully immerse ourselves in moments of reflection on the giftedness of the thing that is before us, which allows us then to enter into that flow state and allows, hopefully, emerging out of that right engagement with God's goodness and the goodness that God presents to us in the present moment, it will also lead to the flourishing and the right ordering of worlds around us. But to do that, we have to learn how to rightly order our attention. We have to learn how to invest the energy of our conscious experience in worthwhile endeavors. And so in the next episode, what we're going to do is we're going to keep exploring Csikszentmihalyi's work in flow, and we're going to talk about what he calls the anatomy of consciousness and how attention gets expressed as psychic energy. Don't think like Professor X. We're not talking about psychic on that level. We're talking about psychological energy, the energy of our conscious attention. How does this impact our ability to enter into the flow state? And as a Christian, how does it impact our ability to properly respond to the goodness that God presents before us, to opportunities to engage and commune with Him, and to contribute to the flourishing of the world around us? We'll talk all about that next time on Deep Talks. Thanks again for listening to today's episode. As I mentioned in the previous episode where we're talking about some of the work of Byung-Chul Han, I am reflecting on the usage of my energy and attention. And I want to have it rightly ordered around God's will and purposes. And so I've been reflecting on what I've been giving my attention to. I say that all as a means to say, if you've been used to reaching out and connecting with me on social media, I have temporarily, potentially permanently deactivated my Twitter account, and my Instagram is pretty much dormant. And so if you're trying to reach out to me there, you're not going to get responses from me, but I am investing my energy and attention into my Patreon page. That just becomes like the one place I'm going to right now, post things. And even if you aren't wanting to contribute to this podcast, that's totally fine. You can still follow me over there on Patreon. You can make a Patreon account and be a free follower. And so there are things that I will do that I'll post over there that you can stay connected with. And if you have a question, you can reach out, and I believe you can even message me. I have to check into that. I think you can still message me, even if you aren't a paid patron who is supporting the podcast. But if you are, there's a bunch of wonderful perks that I hope you find beneficial to your life. And it certainly helps me continue to produce this podcast. I can't do this podcast without the generous support of people like Clint, Brandon, Daniel, Dave, Eli, Garth, Gerald, Jean-Marc, Jesse, John-Marc, Josie, J-Tom, Justin, Kate, Luke, Matthew, Nick, Paul, Rob, Sam P., Stephen H., and Tim B. Thank you all for your generous support. I really can't do this without you. Reach out with your questions. I'd love to hear more about your own experiences being in the flow state. There's a discussion forum available on my Patreon page for this episode where I would love to read more of your thoughts and experiences. And it'd be interesting as we continue this series. I don't know how long it's going to go. We're going to see. I'm going to kind of take us through important sections of this book and do some reflection on it together. So maybe you want to pick up the book as well. And then you can kind of follow along, and maybe you'd be able to bring up points that I neglect in these lectures. So share with me your thoughts. I'd love to hear from them. Best way to do that, again, is on Patreon. And until next time, we'll talk again soon.